From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. If you read blogs or use Facebook and Twitter, you might have online friends who write about coffee, makeup, kids' toys, or other products they like. Advertisers try to take advantage of those relationships by paying bloggers and tweeters. Well, now the Federal Trade Commission has passed rules that will require those people to be open about their connections. NPR's Laura Seidel explains.
Andrew Bennett might not make millions from product endorsements like LeBron James, but he does have a few hundred followers on his blog who take him seriously.
With the Soda Club Home Soda Maker, you can give your friends and family delicious, fresh soda whenever they come over to visit.
Bennett didn't just happen to have this around his house and decide to blog about it. He actually seeks out products he can promote for money from a site called Social Spark, which lists advertisers who want to pay to get on blogs.
Basically, that allows you to pick and choose what opportunities you'd like to blog about.
Bennett says bloggers can make between $50 and $500, depending on how many followers they have. Social Spark also requires bloggers to tell their readers that they're being paid, but it doesn't necessarily tell them how.
There is no specific one way to disclose, and we are trying very hard to disclose every way possible.
Now Bennett and other bloggers will be required by the FTC to tell people when they are blogging or tweeting for money. Even though Bennett already does this, he's worried. He says the regulations are very vague about how he must disclose his connections. He's not alone. Advertisers are also concerned.
Pretty interesting how to figure out where to put disclosure. Is it an audio platform? Is it visual? Is it limited like Twitter is?
Anthony DiResta is an attorney who consults with major advertising firms. Officials at the FTC say they want to work with advertisers to come up with clear policies. Kelly McBride of the nonprofit Poynter Institute for Journalism thinks this is an important step because many consumers can tell a commercial from a program on television, but people can be naive when their Facebook friend says they're a fan of McDonald's.
For the most part, people assume that those are truly genuine, positive reviews of whatever product it is.
McBride hopes the new regulations will help create more awareness among the general public about how advertising works in the new world of social media. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. By the time our next guest got to our studio this morning, I had already used his company's service at least a dozen times, probably more. Eric Schmidt owns My Window on the World. I work in front of a computer all day. He is the CEO of Google. In addition to running the cyber behemoth, he's also an advisor to President Obama on technology, and he's in Washington today. In light of how much we depend on Google for information, I asked, how does Google see its relationship to all that information? As a neutral conduit, an editor, a business? Well, here's what Eric Schmidt said.
We try to get you to the information as fast as possible. And more importantly, we try to get you to the website that has that information as fast as possible. Mm-hmm. We see ourselves as an intermediary and a particularly sophisticated one. We know a lot about you. We know a lot about what you care about. And by using very sophisticated algorithms, we can rank and rate and get you to your answer quicker than anybody else.
But when you're getting me to my answer, first of all, you said that you know a lot about me. Is that consensual? Have I at some point said it's okay for you to know a lot about me? Can I bail out of your knowing a lot about me if I choose?
We work really, really hard to give you choices. There's opt-in approaches. There's opt-out approaches. You can actually let us know that you want us to keep your searches and that we can use them to refine our answers later. You can also tell us that you never want us to keep any of your information. You can go somewhere in between.
And in terms of the information that answers, have you in some way edited that information? Is it random with regard to whatever is on the internet? Have you brought either editorial or economic judgments to that process?
The core principle of Google since its founding was a separation of editorial and essentially advertising. From our perspective, we work very, very hard to keep the answers, the natural search answers, completely unbiased with respect to economics. If you're an advertiser and you want to have a higher ranking of the ads, you can pay more, and through our auction you may get that. But you cannot, as an advertiser, affect our normal answers.
You mean the ads that might pop up based on what you know about me and what I'm and the words that I'm searching for, that's for sale, that's advertising. But the sequence in which information comes up in the search, you say that's completely free of economic concern or editorial judgment?
It is completely free of economic concern from Google. Because we drive so much traffic through those mechanisms, an awful lot of people pay attention to their rankings. And then we make algorithmic changes to make our overall quality better. Some will be disadvantaged, some will be promoted, and that's an artifact of how we do our ranking. We're always trying to make our ranking, literally the answers, the choices that we give you, more accurate.
Well, I'd like you to, I'm going to read to you a quotation that I'm sure you're familiar with. It was what Google Vice President Jonathan Rosenberg wrote in a blog. He said, and I quote, "We won't and shouldn't try to stop the faceless scribes of drivel, but we can move them to the back row of the arena." If that doesn't mean we can spot drivel, our algorithms can somehow spot drivel and make it less prominent, what does it mean?
Well, what it means is that there's an awful lot of people who write an awful lot that's not very useful, and we want our algorithm to recognize the stuff which has one viewer or one reader versus the stuff that is really used by an awful lot of people, and that's how we do our ranking.
So that, for example, if I put in the name of somebody and that comes up in a number of little red blogs, but also in a number of major newspapers, which have many other citations, the algorithm will favor the big newspaper in that
case. We tend to favor larger and more established sources of content.
Very controversial aspect of Google's operations is in China, where, as I understand it, and I've seen this demonstrated by our China correspondent and by others over there, accounts of what's happening in Tibet or stories about Falun Gong that are not critical are not way at the back of the queue. They're just not there. Have you acceded in that case to censorship and state power?
We made a very controversial decision a few years ago to enter China, and by that we have to follow their law. Their law does require a very precise form of omission or censorship around certain things. So, for example, the Falun Gong is omitted. But we did something very unusual for China. When we omit something in an answer, we also tell the Chinese surfer that that information was omitted. Now, you can imagine, if you're a Chinese citizen and you see that, what you'll be doing with that information.
But it's an interesting question because we'd like to think of the Internet, and Google at the moment is almost synonymous with the Internet for many of us, as a great liberalizing force that's bringing information to all. On the other hand, as sophisticated as the algorithms are, they can be devised in such ways as to tailor what is kept out of the eyes of specific groups of people in specific locations, or I assume with specific kinds of profiles or cookies. You could also figure that one out.
We've chosen not to do the latter. In the case of China...
Thank you for that.
Yes, of course. In the case of China, we have told everyone exactly what we're doing and why we're doing it. We are subject to Chinese law, which we obviously are opposed to. The decision that we ultimately came to with China was it was better to engage rather than be estranged. The Chinese citizens will eventually rebel over some of these, in our view, idiotic restrictions because they are now aware of them. They now know that information is being withheld from them by law and that those laws will be overturned from public pressure over time.
As someone who I've probably already Googled, you know, a few dozen things today before seeing you, you know a tremendous amount about me. Google does, about the things I'm interested in searching for. And I don't know how to use any of the opt-outs that you described. I didn't even know it was available to me. So far as I know, you know it all. What do you do with that? Is it available to companies, to politicians, to parties? Who gets it?
The information is not available to anybody unless it's under a court order. We use it in anonymous form internally, and then after about 18 months, we forget it entirely.
As far as you're concerned, I'm a year and a half old.
And the reason we keep it for any length of time is, one, we actually need it to make our algorithms better. But more importantly, there is a legitimate case of the government or particularly the police function or so forth wanting, with a federal subpoena and so forth, being able to get access to that information.
If the Democratic Party of the state of California came to you and said, can we get a good list from you? Would you give them that?
We would not unless they had a court order, and we would fight that court order. We've had a series of situations where the government and various parts of it have actually tried to overreach, and they tried to ask too much information, and we've used the federal judiciary to limit those orders to a very, very reasonable list.
And
so the answer to your question is no.
Is that a Google absolute global, or is it something which if you, you know, engaged in China or another country where they don't have similar protections, you know, they play by different rules in that country?
It's a fundamental part of our trust with our end users, and it applies globally.
Eric Schmidt, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Eric Schmidt, who is the CEO of Google.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. Some years, reporting the Nobel Prize in Physics means explaining some pretty unfamiliar stuff. Quarks, broken symmetry, magnetoresistance. Well, not so this year. With today's Nobel Prizes, the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences is celebrating tangible discoveries, things you use every day. One scientist is honored for inventing fiber optic communications, and two others got the nod for inventing the technology that is the basis of digital cameras. NPR's Richard Harris tells their stories.
Let's turn back the clock a few decades and drop in on Bell Labs in New Jersey. This is where the transistor was invented and where the laser came into being. It was a place of remarkable ideas. Willard Boyle and George Smith were part of that magical time. Smith says in October of 1969, they were trying to outsmart another part of Bell Labs to come up with a new type of computer memory.
So Boyle and I frequently got together to kick around ideas, and this was one of them. The actual invention took place one afternoon.
The idea, drawn on a blackboard, was a new kind of electronic circuit they called a charge-coupled device. It could work as a new kind of computer memory, but Smith realized it had a lot more potential than that.
It became immediately obvious that this device would also make a very good imaging device.
CCDs can capture light and turn it into simple electronic signals, so a visual image could be converted instantly into digital form. Digital photography was born. The military was intensely interested in this for spy satellites, and the first commercial application was for digital TV cameras. Digital still cameras lagged by quite some time, Smith says, because compact memory was still hard to come by. That is, until flash memory was invented. Smith knows this story intimately.
I had a small exploratory research department at the laboratories, about 30 people, I guess, and the flash memory was invented in my department also.
Smith and Boyle came up with dozens of inventions during their time at Bell Labs, often working together. And then, when Smith was still in his mid-50s, he simply hung up the towel.
I retired in 1986, jumped in my sailboat, sailed around the world.
And he took 17 years to do it, lingering especially long in the South Pacific with his sweetheart. Why, you might wonder, would a prolific and highly successful inventor just call it quits?
If one is honest about it, as you grow older, your inventive abilities deteriorate. I have run into many people at Bell Labs when they were younger who were really great, and then they sort of went downhill, even though they didn't admit it.
These days, Bell Labs is no longer seen as a place of unfettered creativity. But Smith and Boyle can see for themselves how their inventions changed the world. CCDs are not just in cameras, they are in satellites, medical devices, and notably, telescopes. Peter Stockman at the Space Telescope Science Institute says they have revolutionized astronomy.
Practically anything in the last 30 years would have been essentially impossible without CCDs.
Hubble's incredible images are captured on CCDs, and so are the images taken by telescopes all around the world. CCDs helped astronomers study the black holes that lie at the heart of galaxies and measure the age of the universe. And now Willard Boyle and George Smith can add a punctuation mark to their careers, the Nobel Prize. Smith is still trying to find the words to describe it all.
Well, when I wake up, I'll let you know.
George Smith and Willard Boyle share half of the $1.4 million prize. The other half goes to Charles Kao, who revolutionized global communications with his work in fiber optics. Richard Harris, NPR News.
You may use teleconferencing, meeting with work colleagues by video instead of flying to a business meeting, which has become more popular as the economy has gone down. Our last word in business today is telecrime stopping. A woman in the Philippines was looking at a webcam that she uses to communicate with her husband. He lives 8,000 miles away in Oklahoma City. She was keeping an eye on the house with the video cameras, when suddenly she saw not her husband, but three burglars in the home. She picked up the phone and called her husband. He called police, who nabbed the suspects and then nailed them after emailing their photos to the woman in the Philippines for identification from another hemisphere. And that's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. We'll be right back.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Bloch.
And I'm Robert Siegel. We've reported here on the use of texting, blogging, and tweeting by all sorts of protest movements abroad. But the most recent case, and the arrest of someone tweeting live about protests, took place in the not-so-exotic confines of Pittsburgh. A self-described anarchist who was tweeting at the G20 summit was arrested. Elliot Madison was accused of directing others to avoid arrest. Madison's home in New York City was searched. He was charged with hindering apprehension or prosecution, criminal use of a communication facility, and possession of instruments of crime. We asked law professor and former prosecutor Paul Butler about this today. We wondered, is telling protesters that there's a cop up ahead arresting protesters any different from blinking your headlights on the highway to signal there's a cop up ahead with a radar gun?
There's no universal agreement about whether when you do that, you're committing a crime. So in a few jurisdictions, people have actually been charged with traffic offenses for warning about police. So in a sense, this is a glorified version of that.
And that would include busting people for communicating logistics to other demonstrators about where to go?
That's the very difficult decision the judge will have to make. So these cases present difficult First Amendment issues. It's perfectly legal to protest, but it's not legal to help the bad guy run away. So it's a thin line, not a thick line, between those two.
Although the bad guy in this case, we understand the bad guy when he is purveying child pornography or selling drugs. In this case, the bad guy would be the protester who might be arrested by a cop if he goes down First Street instead of running down Second Street.
And it's tough because the police have to make these difficult on-the-spot determinations about where the protesters can go. This information may not be transmitted to the protesters, and so often they're arrested for conduct that they didn't even know was illegal. It wasn't illegal 5 minutes ago. And so, in a sense, all of these tweets and Twitters are just designed to get the message out about what's legal now.
The New York Times has some of the messages that were exchanged during the protests against the G20. Some of the tweets, SWAT teams rolling down Fifth Avenue, that would be one. Another one was, report received that police are nabbing anyone that looks like a protester. Black block, stay alert, watch your friends. What does it sound like to you?
Well, you know, some of it sounds like pure journalism, just reporting what's going on the scene, not unlike what I heard when I watched some protest on the local news. You know, the part about watch out for your friend, that's a little bit more ambiguous. But one concern is that sometimes the police have arrested innocent people. So if I were the defense attorney, I'd say they're just trying to give people information so that they can conform their conduct to the law.
Now, but let's say if I were a journalist tweeting about protests and I sent out a message, SWAT teams rolling down Fifth Avenue, my intent is to inform. It's not necessarily to direct people's conduct. On the other hand, when people are informed of something, they decide what to do on the basis of that information. Is there any bright line in law between when you're just giving somebody the fact of the situation or when the fact of the situation, that is, I see cops are about to beat down your door, flush it quick, when that information really is part of a trying to thwart the law?
Yeah, well, intent or motive is key. So if the government can prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the idea was to help the protesters evade the police and to prevent the protesters' illegal activities from being discovered, then they've broken the law. But that's a lot that the government will have to prove, and, you know, it may be difficult based on the evidence.
New law will be made in these cases in the coming months.
And the law is used to adapting to new technology. You know, for there was a time when the telephone was new, and then there was another time when computers were new, and people used these new instruments for both legal activity and for political organizing, and sometimes for illegal activity. And what law has to do is to figure out the difference.
Professor Butler, thank you very much.
It's great to be here.
Paul Butler, a former federal prosecutor, is a professor of law at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C.
In New Orleans tomorrow, there will be a public unveiling of a new home in the Lower Ninth Ward, a house designed to float. The Lower Ninth Ward was largely wiped away by floodwaters after Hurricane Katrina. The Float House is the brainchild of Morphosis Architects and its founder, Tom Main. He's a winner of what's often called architecture's Nobel Prize, the Pritzker, and he joins us from New York. Welcome to the program.
My pleasure.
And this, Tom, I guess would be a pretty tempting idea. You're right by the Industrial Canal there in New Orleans. Why not figure out a house that could float? How does it work?
It's kind of amazingly simple. What we did is we rethought the idea of a house in terms of the potential conditions of the flooding that took place in Katrina. And what we did is two things. One, we gave it a chassis, borrowing from an automobile or a boat maybe. And this is a building that has a chassis, and it's 3 feet deep, 15 feet wide, 55 feet long, meaning it gets on a truck, can be shipped. And it's made out of polystyrene foam, and it's covered with glass-reinforced concrete. And what does that do? It produces a raft. It floats. And it's thought about as a seatbelt. I mean, hopefully it never gets used. But when it gets used, it's important.
Well, the idea is, though, that this would not float away. So what actually anchors us to the ground and keeps it from just getting inundated with water?
There are two vertical guideposts which are anchored into the ground that keep it moving purely vertically to the feet of 12 feet so it doesn't drift. The floating thing wouldn't work. It has to be stable and within the property. And the these vertical guideposts keep it in control.
You know, I guess ideally you would want to test this house and make sure it does what you think it's going to do. I can't imagine you were able to do that, though.
Indeed. No. We had we worked with two structural engineers and developing this prototype. And they did extensive computer simulations. And we modeled this house for hurricane flooding conditions that were parallel to the requirements that followed Katrina. It went through exhaustive structural simulations that mimicked the conditions that would take place in a hurricane.
Now, your house is being built for the Make It Right Foundation in New Orleans, and I've seen some of their other houses in the Lower Ninth Ward, and they're just built way up off the ground. Why didn't you want to do that?
Well, it was a really interesting problem. How do you keep the sense of community and the continuity of the neighborhood and at the same time deal with this very extreme condition of the flooding? And what we decided was that, the vertical solution seemed to us one way to solve it. But we thought we had a more interesting way that we could keep the house on the ground. It has a front porch. It's basically a meter off the ground, so it's a traditional situation. It's a huge amount of the population, a large amount of the population, is are elderly or people that maybe wouldn't want to use stairs going up 14 feet, 12 feet, whatever it is. Essentially, you have to look at all of the components of the house and how it works in an intricate sense.
If there were to be a flood and this house were to start to float, to rise up, what would happen to electrical connections, gas, anything like that?
There's a break-off for that, and the same with electricity. And the house has a battery power, an emergency that'll last 3 days. It's been pretty thoroughly thought about in terms of its both its everyday sustainability and its emergency condition.
Well, Tom Main, thanks for talking to us about the Float House.
My pleasure.
That's architect Tom Main, founder of Morphosis Architects and creator of the new Float House, designed for a future homeowner in New Orleans' Lower Ninth Ward. And you can see a picture of the house at npr.org.